Welcome to the Development Policy Centre podcast. I'm Ashley Betteridge. In this episode of the podcast, we bring you the recording from the second half of our 2014 ODE Evaluation Forum, looking at the lessons from Australian Aid Report. You can view the presentation slides from this event on our website, devpolicy.anu.edu.au. Everyone, I think we might make a start. We didn't have any other volunteers to chair this session, so I've stepped in. As you know, I'm Ashley, I work at the Development Policy Centre. So this session we're going to look at the lessons from Australian Aid Report and the Quality Review of Aid Program Performance Reports. We are going to first hear from Jo Hall, who is the Evaluation Director at ODE. We don't have a representative here from DFAT, as Andrew Collins was unable to make it, so we might get some quick remarks from Derek on that front. And then Robin Davies from Dev Policy is going to speak as well. So without any further ado, I'll hand over to Jo.
Thanks very much. So my name's Jo Hall. I've been with the Office of Development Effectiveness on and off since it began in 2006. And I'm talking about the 2013 lessons from Australian Aid and the 2013 Quality Review of Aid Program Performance Reports. As I put together that rather wordy title, it reminded me of when we wrote the LAR, the Lessons from Australian Aid Report. The recommendation from the independent review was for a evaluation synthesis and quality assurance report. So that was the task that was given to us. My first response to that was, we'd better get a new title for that, and because nobody's going to read an evaluation synthesis and quality assurance report. So we had a bit of a workshop in ODE, and we came up with Lessons from Australian Aid as this fabulous title. This is not a trivial point, because we had the annual review of aid effectiveness was also being produced, and there was the annual report being produced as well. So there were three reports coming out more or less at the same time about the Australian Aid Program. So we had to be quite mindful of distinguishing this report from the others, and we decided to take a very sort of learning take on the report rather than the accountability functions that were more served by the annual review and the annual report. So I'm going to take this presentation in two parts. The first part is to talk about the lessons, which is basically the first few chapters of Lessons from Australian Aid. And then I'll talk about Chapter 5, which is the Performance and Quality Assurance chapter. And that will look at both the quality and implementation reports, but will also cover the other report I'm supposed to cover, which is the 2013 Quality Review of Aid Program Performance Reports. So if that makes sense, I'll keep going. But the kind of context for this report, we set it quite clearly in the characteristics, if you like, of Australian Aid. Because Australian Aid has a particular geographic focus. It's quite unusual in that most of the countries are right nearby to us. That we are a leading donor in 9 countries. That's very unusual as donors go, to be a leading donor, and those countries tend to be extremely poor, which is, if you like, part of another characteristic of fragility that we find in the countries of most interest and engagement by Australia. More than half of Australia's country-specific aid goes to fragile and conflict-affected states. And the other characteristic at the time of writing was that the aid program was going through a period of growth basically has grown 80% in dollar terms between 2007 and 2012. So it's quite important to kind of look at all these lessons in the context of the whole of the aid program. And so kind of being aware of the audience today, I thought I'd better say something about the method for the synthesis. I'm not sure I've got all that much to say. So we basically had 6 evaluations, and we needed to somehow synthesise these 6 evaluations. It's not a large number, and they're very disparate evaluations looking at very different topics. So what we did was we kind of looked for common findings from different evaluations, and then we started to kind of group them with lots of post-it notes and Excel spreadsheets and so on, and tried to group them by commonality, if you like. And we were looking really for things that were practical and a little bit interesting. So those were the kind of the criteria. I had Simon Henderson, who used to be an advisor with the Office of Development Effectiveness, is now works privately out of the UK. I had him working with me, and we sort of tic-tacked on grouping these various lessons. We went through various peer reviews. It went up to the executive. It went up to the Development Effectiveness Working Group. It went up to the IEC, the Independent Evaluation Committee, who were particularly helpful in providing feedback and framing of the lessons. We also drew on the annual programme performance reports to kind of supplement some examples to try and better illustrate the points that we were making. So that was the process. And we basically came up with three sort of headline lessons. And the first lesson was to do with policy dialogue. And basically the policy dialogue evaluation that the Office of Development Effectiveness had released was really making the point that there's a very inconsistent understanding of what is meant by policy dialogue. And we try to use this chapter to kind of flesh out what on earth it means, and then to illustrate that with examples. So the first sort of half of this chapter talks about the range of channels by which policy dialogue can occur, really to help people to recognise when it's happening. So one of those has to do with supporting good quality evidence and linking that to policy. So, for example, in Indonesia, in the Solomon Islands, in Papua New Guinea, there are a number of examples given where Australia is working very closely, for example, in Indonesia with the Office of the Vice President, to strengthen the evidence base on which policies are then being based. And I think this is a really important and sometimes a bit invisible method, if you like, of policy dialogue. Another thing that came out of the evaluations was the need to build capacity for policy dialogue among local stakeholders. So particularly in those fragile contexts that I've been talking about, often, you know, you might have one or two people in the planning department or whatever. There's a need to supplement that capacity and develop capacity for actually engaging in policy dialogue. An example that we use in the report is of working with both NGOs in Indonesia and with the justice institutions so that they can both work better with each other. So basically building the capacity of both to engage with each other in order to get improved policy coming out the other end. A third point about the, or third channel, if you like, is to do with bringing frontline experience to bear on policy. So in the Philippines, for example, the civil society engagement evaluation talks about Procurement Watch, which is a very small NGO, but it works directly with parent-teacher groups across the country to basically measure the quality of the chairs and tables that are getting delivered through the procurement system, and then reporting back and holding the government to account. This idea of bringing very frontline experience to bear is important also in Indonesia, where there's a pilot scheme, like a HIBA grant scheme for water, which was tested using Australian funds as a pilot. When that was found to work, then the government was able to adopt this as a new method, if you like, of implementing water supply. And so that's another channel or way that frontline experience can be used to influence policy. And the last example was around creating and positioning flexible funding mechanisms or instruments. So the again, in Indonesia, we were able to place a funding instrument that could respond. So at the moment that it looked like a policy change was possible or there was room to move forward with a reform, Australia was very fast to respond because they had a mechanism in place, whereas other donors were kind of left left with all their bureaucracy, we were actually in a good position to respond to that. And the second part of this lesson has to do with when you're engaging in policy dialogue, always making sure there is a clear purpose to it and that the advisors that are being used are credible. So these are fairly self-evident points, but I make them nonetheless because it still shows up in evaluations and in annual program performance reports as sometimes being an issue. So the credibility of the advisors is not just to do with their technical credibility, but it has to do with long-term country experience. It has to do with sensitivity to political, social contexts in which they're working. And there's very clear correlation between the better advisors are more experienced and more sensitive than the not-so-good advisors. And the other point about this is having a clear purpose to the policy dialogue. So in the Solomon Islands, where there was a core economic working group, it was very clear what the purpose was, or the objective, if you like, from the point of view of the Solomon Islands government. They really wanted to kind of gather the donors all in one spot. They wanted more money to come through their systems, and they basically wanted the Solomon Islands to become more viable. The donors had very clear purpose as well. So this is World Bank, AusAid, Ramsey donors, New Zealand, and so on. They wanted reform to happen in the Solomon Islands. They wanted it to become more viable, and they wanted to coordinate with each other, so they were all singing off the same spreadsheet. This worked. This is a really good example of where there was clear purpose. The second lesson really has to do with the need to integrate Australia's work with civil society and the private sector into the mainstream of its programming. So not to consider it something marginal, but to actually look carefully at the roles of all of the agents of development, not just the government, and figure out what makes sense for the aid program to work with among each of those different drivers of change, if you like. And in Vanuatu, they actually undertook a drivers of change analysis back in 2007 that identified not just the role of government, but also the role of the chiefs, the role of the churches, and so on in the development process, and that actually shifted the way that the Vanuatu program engaged with those various actors. There's an example in the report of where we didn't do so well, where in Papua New Guinea, for example, AusAid and ACR were working with the Research Institute in Papua New Guinea to look at different taro varieties that were resistant to leaf blight and taro beetle. And once we'd found those, that was great, but then they hadn't been working with all the partners to actually do the outreach. So they hadn't really looked at the beginning of the design at who were all the interested parties and what the roles of everybody was in that process. And so that eventually the project came good, but it would have had much earlier impact and greater impact if they'd actually thought about everybody's roles sooner in that process. And the second point here is that the aid program can play a really important role in brokering the relations between the government and civil society and the private sector. So in Papua New Guinea, for example, where the churches play a major role in delivering services, education and health services in very remote areas of Papua New Guinea, there tends to be not very much engagement by AusAid or by the Australian Aid Program in working with the health program beyond government and with those church groups. They've been working quite working with the church groups separately, but not working as part of that health program. So a more positive example is in Vanuatu again, where the program had been supporting Save the Children Fund to run a village health worker scheme. And after a number of years of doing that, they managed to get the government to take on that contract with Save the Children Fund for these village health workers. The government then took it on as their own, village health workers became part of the system and expanded with the government's own funding to reach more of the islands in Vanuatu. So that brokering relationship is quite an important one that the aid program can play, and you know, should be looking for opportunities to do that in by mainstreaming more of the engagement with civil society and with the private sector in our regular programs. And the third lesson has to do with capacity building, basically saying that we need to take a more institutional view of capacity building. In Cambodia, the law and justice program in Cambodia had taken a fairly standard model of capacity building in to work across all the different Department of Justice and the corrections and the courts and so on and so on. But it wasn't actually getting any traction except for the work with the prisons, mainly because it didn't have an understanding of the institutional environment in which it was operating. So in fact, there were forces at play that were deliberately keeping the Justice Department as a weak institution. People didn't want them to have so much influence over what was going on in the courts. And corruption as well was a major factor that was kind of thwarting all these capacity building efforts. So they redesigned the whole program as a result of the law and justice evaluation so that it would be more likely to actually have some kind of success in capacity building. The other point here has to do with avoiding isolated activities. There's numbers of the evaluations that point to the limited impact of small, isolated activities. This is quite a controversial point. When we talked to our other government departments about this point, they were a little bit upset. But the evidence is there that these activities do not have sustained impact. So, for example, in Papua New Guinea, again, the HIV program was kind of worked to establish these fairly standalone HIV treatment clinics. It would have been a whole lot better if they'd actually taken a step back and done those as primary healthcare clinics. There would have been more sustained impact in a broader across a broader sector. Another example is the Philippines evaluation basically said that the most impact was from the long-term sustained engagement on education. The rest of the program was relatively dispersed and fragmented, and so was having limited impact. And I think this, the whole of government part of this is actually an area that got its own little section in this chapter because quite often we see that some of those isolated activities are in fact from other government departments. So there were things coming out of the law and justice evaluation, for example, that showed that there were a number of workshops, training programs and so on that were kind of ad hoc, being run across the Pacific, pulling people out of their regular day-to-day jobs and not actually adding up to anything. And those kind of, trying to persuade these other government departments to take a more institutional view of capacity building is a bit of a challenge, I think, in the way forward. The AFP has been making quite a lot of progress in that. So another element of this has to do with the AFP basically taking in a model to other countries that is an Australian model. So they would look at the Pacific Police as sort of broken versions of our own police force and try and fix it rather than stepping back and looking at the political and cultural and other contexts and then working out which areas you were likely to get success in. But they've started to shift their understanding on that, so that's quite exciting. So that's really the lessons. The three lessons are to do with policy dialogue, integrating civil society and the private sector into the aid program, and getting more, taking a more institutional view of capacity building. The second part of this presentation will focus on chapter 5, which is, it's only 10 pages long, but it is quite an intense 10 pages. And sitting behind those 10 pages is a lot of analysis and work that went on around two reporting instruments that the aid program uses. One of those is the quality at implementation reports, and the other is the annual program performance reports. Quality at implementation reports, they were introduced in 2007. They basically look at individual activities. And each of those activities is required each year to produce a report that assesses themselves, if you like, but it's the activity managers who write these reports, that assesses how well those projects are going against six criteria. And then it rates them on a 6-point scale. 1 to 3 is not satisfactory. 4 to 6 is satisfactory. It applies to all those activities that are $3 million or over, and there's basically 500-odd reports produced every year. This last year, the year of this report, in 2013, we had 100% compliance. Is that right? More or less 99%, thank you. 99, I mean, it is a remarkable compliance level. So these reports have become very well established in the system as a sort of ready means of measuring what's going on in these various activities. The other reporting instrument are our annual program performance reports. Now, these look at a country or regional performance against country or regional strategies and their objectives. So they're basically used to measure whether programs are progressing satisfactorily towards meeting those 3 or 5 year objectives or whatever sitting in those strategy documents. And basically, they rank them green, amber, red as to whether or not, you know, the degree of happiness with meeting or likelihood of meeting those objectives within the lifetime of the strategy. Again, these were introduced in 2007, 2008. 34 reports were produced last year. These are a really good way of capturing not just what's going on at the activity level, but also the policy dialogue aspects of the program. So policy dialogue tends not to be captured by the quality at implementation reports. It's becoming an increasingly important, significant aspect of the aid program, and so this is the place where you can actually talk about how well that's working, how well the strategy is working to achieve the objectives, and whether anything needs to change. So these were our two sources for Chapter 5, and I'll talk about them each in turn. I'll talk about what the reports say about quality and performance of the aid program, and then I'll talk about ODE's assessment of how robust the reports are. So, the quality of implementation reports. The six criteria are across the bottom here, and this is the last 3 years of the of reporting. Basically, those that are rated satisfactory, so those that are rated 4, 5, or 6 in the 6-point scheme. And what this graph showed us was a couple of things. First of all, that there's a clear majority of activities are satisfactory across all of the criteria. It also showed us that it's pretty stable, that, you know, effectiveness is pretty much around the 80-something percent mark and has been for 3 years. And so it suggests, that stability suggested to us that the ones that were performing weaker had more of a structural element to them than a sort of time element. So monitoring and evaluation is the weakest performing of all of the criteria. This has always been a bit of a worry for us in ODE. Effectiveness means how well the activity is likely to meet its objectives. The monitoring and evaluation thing is basically saying how good are your monitoring systems. So people are saying, yeah, we're going to meet our objectives, but our monitoring systems are not really brilliant. And so we've always struggled with that anomaly, and in fact we're planning on doing some more work to understand why people are struggling with monitoring systems in the coming year. But one of the things we actually looked at, we then did some analysis on the monitoring scores themselves, and you've got a complicated graph that I haven't troubled you with on the PowerPoint. But basically, we looked at the variability of the monitoring ratings. So basically, the ones that performed well in monitoring and evaluation tended to be more consistent in terms of variability, whereas the most variety of scores were found in the sectors that were performing not so well on monitoring and evaluation. So sectors like improved government or environment and natural resources scored fairly low on monitoring, on their monitoring systems, and but also had the widest range of scores. So that gave us some hope that at least some of those would provide some positive examples that we could help share with the weaker ones to help bring the average scores up. But it would also give us some insight into what was going on and why were people struggling to actually measure the performance of their activities. The next graph I will trouble you with was to do with sustainability and effectiveness. So one of the things that we noticed was that the effectiveness scores were high. Sustainability scores were pretty high, but not as high as effectiveness. So this wasn't too surprising. Sustainability is much harder to achieve, whereas you might meet your objectives. Sustaining that achievement is a different story altogether, particularly in the kinds of countries where Australia is working. But we broke it down by sector to see what that would tell us. And again, maybe not surprisingly, we found that different sectors performed differently. Improved government was the one that stood out of this particular graph to us as being both low on effectiveness, below average on effectiveness, and way below average on sustainability. And part of the reason for this is because most of the places where we're working to improve governance are in fact those fragile countries, and so you're going to end up with where it's more difficult to achieve a sustainable result. But in any case, we handed this finding across to the governance section to think about how they were going to better support programs, both in defining sustainability and understanding what it actually means in different contexts, as well as looking at what those what is behind this graph. So the other thing we looked at then was can we believe all these scores anyway? Every year for the last 5 years or so, we've been doing a spot check of QAI scores, where we take a random sample. This particular year we took 77 out of more or less 500 reports. And we also took a target sample last year of all those activities that were rated unsatisfactory the previous year, but this year were rated satisfactory. We wanted to check something because the CAPF basically has a requirement in that if you have an activity that is not satisfactory for two or more consecutive years, it is it goes into a pool of poor performing projects that then require particular management attention and more drama than any activity manager wants to face. So we wanted to check if anybody was gaming with these scores and in fact pretending that their not satisfactory project was in fact satisfactory to avoid going through this drama. And what we found on that particular group was quite surprising and very pleasing for us, was that actually those scores were more robust than the ones that were than the random sample. So we were very confident that people were not playing the system, that was people were in fact using the QAI process as a way of making sure that more management attention was given to those poor performing programs. What we found with the random sample is up here, basically that we can be pretty confident in the ratings that people are giving to their activities. There's a little bit of a worry around sustainability. I've already talked about that as being a worry anyway. This just adds to that worry. And there's a worry around gender as well. So those are less robust as scores, and it's something that we'll continue to be monitoring and actively working with into the future. Okay, so then we come to the annual program performance report. Sorry, they've been renamed the AID program performance reports. So there was a separate review that has been published about this aspect of the of this quality assurance part of Chapter 5 in the Lessons from Australian Aid. And this year we actually took quite a disciplined approach to undertaking this quality review. We looked at two things. We looked at what were the reports saying about performance, but then we looked against a number of quite fixed criteria. How good is the quality of these reports? So first up, what the reports are saying about the performance of the AID program. We compared last year with this year, and we, I mean, at first glance, you'd say, oh, that's good, the greens have gone up. We were a little more circumspect in our analysis. The numbers of objectives have changed considerably between the 2 years, and we did not find that there was sufficient consistency in the quality of these reports to be able to draw any firm conclusion from this slight increase in the greens here. What we also did was look quite... we did some analysis of the reports themselves, and we were looking at why was something that was rated red last year now rated amber or green, or something that was rated amber last year now rated green. We looked at why was some things rated red and why were some things rated green. And we basically were looking for insights into what was going on in terms of performance that was helping to bring improvements about in the AID program. And a result of that analysis was the top three findings, if you like, of that analysis were to do with effective policy dialogue, capacity building that focuses on institutional support, and reduced program fragmentation were three of the drivers of good performing programs. And we noted a very similar sort of correlation, if you like, with the lessons from Australian Aid that I've talked about in the first few chapters of this report. So in terms of the quality, we found that overall it is improving, but it is inconsistent across the AID program. And there were a number of strengths and a number of weaknesses that were identified, and we've passed these on to management to try and continue to improve these reports into the future. Probably a couple of take-home findings were to do with performance frameworks, like the way that country programs choose to actually measure the performance of their programs. When they had a very clear and sensible way of measuring performance, they had better quality annual program performance reports. When they didn't, the quality was worse. We're going to spend a bit of time this year looking at ways in which different country program areas are measuring the performance of their programs. And the other sort of take-home, I think, is to do with whole-of-government performance is not particularly well reflected in the annual program performance reports. It hasn't been... over a number of years, it's something that that needs to be worked on. But probably the main thing to do with these annual program performance reports is that we can analyse them to death, and we do, but in the end, they need to be used. And if management is not using them to make decisions around the AID program, well, you know, it's a pretty pointless exercise. So annual program performance reports of Australia is quite rare in producing these things. Other donors don't publish such reports. We do. I think they're a really important and valuable part of the AID program. Yes, there's lots of ways they can improve, but probably the single factor that will most improve the quality of the reports is when management actually use them to make programming and budget decisions. So next year, a couple of things on the agenda for ODE. First of all, we're going to look at monitoring systems at activity level. We're going to look at the APPRs and their ways of measuring performance. This year's lessons from Australian Aid, will include a couple of other things. So besides ODE evaluations, the plan is that there's a synthesis of operational evaluations, 86 operational evaluations that the agency has undertaken, that ODE is now preparing, so watch this space for that report to come out. We will include that synthesis as part of the lessons of Australian Aid for next year, so there's a broader range of material that we'll be drawing the lessons from. There's also a number of considerations that we'll have to think about as we look at the LAR for this year, the annual review of aid effectiveness and what the role of that is likely to be. There's a simplification agenda around to do with increasing the threshold for the quality of implementation reports from 3 million to 10 million. The APPRs are now only mandatory for those programs that are more than $50 million. Anyway, there's other stuff going on around the simplification agenda. There are other reporting instruments in the mix to do with like the multilateral scorecards and so on that we haven't addressed yet. And then there's the benchmarks exercise, which we're waiting for the kind of outcomes from that to see how our report, the annual review of aid effectiveness, and the agency's annual report will all relate to the benchmarking. That's it. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jo, for that overview. Definitely a lot to think about there, so I hope everyone's starting to think of some questions for later on. I'd like to invite Derek. Do you want to make a few remarks?
I'll just say a few words, yeah. Thanks. Look, I can't, and I don't want to wear a management hat on this one, but Andrew couldn't make it. I'll just say a few words, and drawing out on some of the observations that Joe left us with. First of all, you'll notice there isn't a management response to the LAR, the Lessons from Australian Aid. That's mainly because all six of the evaluations that were used for the synthesis had their own management responses. So it was felt that they had responses in the original documents. This was in some ways a repackaging, if you like, of the findings of major evaluations over the previous year. And there is also a very short management response to the APPR review, which Joe referred to as one of the products of the performance assessment exercise. If you read the management response to the APPR review, as I sort of evaluate, it always worries me when we get a response that says agree in principle. It sort of sounds to me like we don't agree. But if you read the background to the reasons, I think there is still hope that the findings of this exercise will be taken into account during the transition period that the department's currently going through in terms of rewriting the performance management arrangements. Let me say that traditionally, the QAR reports, APPR reports that we've done every year out of the performance analysis section have not been made public. They've been used as internal management reports. They have always had recommendations, and they've always had management responses. Mostly, the process of implementing management responses has been through refining guidelines and internal systems and processes. So over the years, we've hoped, or we do believe, that the ODE quality control exercise, if you'd like to call it that, has each year sort of pushed the envelope a bit more in the internal processes that the department has. However, all the internal processes are being thrown up in the air a little bit in this current process of reassessing the performance management system, particularly with the benchmarks and the hurdles or the targets. However, those three findings and the three recommendations, I mean, some of them are, again, sometimes it's hard in evaluations to not come up with what sounds like a motherhood sort of statement. But it is really noticeable that the more senior management gets involved in oversighting our internal management systems and uses the products, the more likely they are to be of high quality. And, I do hope that going forward, the department will ensure that this is taken seriously by senior management. The recommendation on the whole of government, for me, is an interesting one, because with the tremendous changes going on in the department over the last 6-9 months. I have seen this sort of fall off the agenda somewhat. It was a very big part of the previous AusAid agenda. It was very hard. We were working hard at bringing in the whole of government brethren, if you like, into what we called uniform standards. ODE itself had, and I assume still has, a role to play in evaluating the owed expenditure of other departments. We've done it in Law and Justice, and we did it in in Rural Development. But it's something which I just haven't heard much about over the last few months. However, the response says, yes, they'll think about this as they create the new system. I think it is going to be important. I think we do need to remember that a fair bit, or a sizable volume of money, does go through other government departments, who also need to be accountable for effective aid's expenditure. So anyway, look, my comment is there really isn't much of a management response, but I'm assured that these findings will be taken into account as the new Butte results reporting system is put in place. Thanks.
Thank you for that, Derek. I'll now ask Robin to come up and make some remarks.
All right. Thanks, Ashley. Now, I'm going to rely heavily on two acronyms previously defined by Joe. So APPR, you know. No, but I didn't realise A, Program Performance Report, and QAI, Quality at Implementation, or otherwise try and avoid jargon. I'm going to come at this, I guess, in reverse order. I want to start by talking about the quality review of APPRs, and I want to do that separately from my commentary on the broader lessons learned report. And that's partly because I think the APPR quality review is a very strong product, and the other report, it's at a different stage in its life cycle. So let's start with the quality review of APPRs. So it represents, I think, a very mature process, which is reviewing a very mature process, right? These quality reviews have been done for a number of years. APPRs have been around since, I think, 2008 or so. And the APPR process has come to be highly valued, particularly by program managers, separate issue around senior management, but by program managers up to, let's say, head of post level or people in charge of programs on desks in Canberra. So APPRs have proven to be a very useful tool. And I think the quality review process is pretty well developed. It uses quite well-honed criteria. They make sense, reflected in those five cornerstone questions, for those of you who've actually looked at the report in detail. And something to emphasise, that the focus in APPRs and in the quality review on the objectives of country programs gives a really good, interesting lens on program performance. And maybe it's something that some of you might have missed in the quick presentation from Joe, but, you know, usually when you talk about program quality, you're talking about an aggregate of activity quality. You're looking at QAI ratings and aggregating those. But the APPR comes at it from a different direction. It looks at what are the objectives of my country program. There might be 5 or 6, and it says, how am I going against those, red, amber, green? Right, so it's a different lens on the same collection of activities, and I think it's a very useful alternative lens. So I just want to quickly pick out 3 headlines that I drew from the APPR quality review, and then talk about a few issues that I have with the review. So the first thing is that if you look back over the last couple of years, as you saw from one of Joe's charts, around half of the objectives of our bilateral aid programs are on track to be achieved. We saw a little bit of variability between the 2 years, but it's about half of the objectives, and there are, you know, let's say an average of 180 objectives across the entire aid program, that down from 200 and something last year. But it's notable that at the activity level, if you think in terms of activities rather than objectives, our expectations are a bit higher than that. We like activities to be satisfactory 75% of the time. So what's going on here? Once you sweep activities under objectives, you're only happy 50% of the time. I'm not suggesting there's a paradox there. I mean, there are some obvious explanations. It could be that our objectives are simply too ambitious or badly framed. It could be that our good activities tend to concentrate under a limited number of objectives. So there's not necessarily a paradox, but the contrast between those two lenses on program performance is, I think, very interesting. And I think there's no question, in fact, that part of the answer, part of the explanation, is that objectives are either too general or quite badly framed. And I recommend having a look at the back of the report, where you can actually see the objectives that have been articulated for all of the country programs. And there's an enormous variety. The best practice by far is Indonesia. It has very clear, very specific objectives. I think Joe will probably completely disagree with me. And then there are other country programs where the objectives are simply read straight off the old Kevin Rudd effective aid framework. We're going to save lives, we're going to create opportunities for all, and so forth. You know, there's an enormous variety of approaches. So I think there's probably a significant job to be done around sharpening up objectives, and then the two lenses might start to converge. So that was one sort of headline for me. Secondly, as we heard, I think, from Joe, programs run by other government departments other than DFAT don't really get the same thorough and frank treatment in APPRs as the programs run by DFAT itself. This no doubt reflects the fact that the pen is pretty much handed to those departments, and that AusAid previously, maybe DFAT now, doesn't feel able to assess those other departments as delivery agents. Low battery. Should we just kill it? It's this one. It's died. That's right.
Rest in peace.
So the idea that AID's a whole of government affair these days tends to put other government departments in a special and rather protected basket, quite separate from multilateral, commercial and non-government delivery agents, and that's not necessarily a good thing. The third headline for me is that it seems that APPRs don't really figure much in policy dialogue. We heard a lot about policy dialogue. Partner governments aren't consulted in their preparation, and the completed APPRs aren't used to inform dialogue on program directions. Or at least that's the case if you just read the APPRs themselves. They don't say that they're used in that way. So that point sits within a broader point about APPR utilisation, which Joe made, that one of the review's recommendations is that senior managers and other staff should actively use the results and management consequences from APPRs to monitor and improve the performance of the aid program. It's pretty remarkable that recommendation needs to be made. But at the same time, implementing it might actually have some unintended consequences. There could be trade-offs between quality and utilisation, such that more fully integrating APPRs into aid management systems might actually reduce their specificity, their frankness, and their usefulness as local management tools, particularly at the level of country offices. So to me, those were some interesting and useful headlines, and maybe there could have been a bit more discussion in the report itself about them, but the points are all made in the report. Now, there's a few things I found about the review that were a bit less compelling. In particular, its treatment of the major drivers of good program performance. It notes that across the 34-odd APPRs which were reviewed, the drivers most frequently cited, as we saw, were effective policy dialogue, a focus on institutional rather than individual capacity building, and reduced fragmentation of effort. It then more or less assumes it to be true that these things are the major drivers of good performance. In one case, policy dialogue, it points to an absence of information on the how, but in general it doesn't ask some larger questions that I might have liked to see about each of those three areas. I'll skip over some material here. This is not really a big criticism, because I think it can actually be questioned whether it's a good idea to try and draw overarching lessons from APPRs in a document that is really about reviewing their quality. That task's probably better done separately via the lessons learned piece that we're going to talk about in a moment. A second point that I found a bit unconvincing was the recommendation that APPRs should all be built around performance assessment frameworks, capital PAF. So this suggestion's in line with a performance management and evaluation policy that goes back to the middle of last year. Before the integration of AusAid into DFAT, and before what Stephen has described as the deregulation of aid management, which we've heard a little bit about. and particularly the deregulation of country strategy and quality assurance processes. Now, it's not that clear to me what a PAF looks like, and even less clear why it isn't good enough just to have a country strategy with very sharply defined objectives and performance indicators. It worries me to proliferate these sort of backroom arcane tools that tend to create incentives for country strategies to remain fairly fluffy and to have those kind of very vague objectives that I talked about. So, got no problem with the intent of that recommendation, but I question the need for a separate tool. The real priority should be to sharpen objectives in country strategies, I think. In fact, I suspect some of the countries regarded as having good performance assessment frameworks might have had bad objectives. And finally, on this review, I wondered about the review's line on proportionality. This is not a point that's strongly made in the review, but there's a suggestion that APPRs should be done either lightly or not at all for very small programs. Well, certainly small programs should have less elaborate strategies, but a small program can be a big program to a partner government. So it seems to me important to undertake the APPR process for all countries where we see fit to say that we have a bilateral aid program at all, rather than folding some of these APPRs under regional exercises. The APPR process is really the one process that links activities to shared objectives in an ongoing way. So to sum up on this, the review's, I think, a high-quality document. It probably should omit its meditations on drivers of performance in the future and leave that to the broader lessons learned exercise. And it might have better recommended sharpening objectives in country strategies rather than imposing performance assessment frameworks. Now, let me move on to the broader report on lessons from Australian aid. This is a very different sort of beast. It's a new report, as we've heard. It represents a process that's still in the very early stages of construction. It's got roughly the same two objectives, in fact, as the APPR review: to review the significant common factors affecting the performance of Australian aid and to assess the quality of key performance reports. Now, it draws upon three sources, as we've heard: the strategic evaluations conducted by ODE over about an 18-month period, QAI reports, and then the APPR review itself, which we've just talked about. It doesn't draw upon what ODE calls operational evaluations, that is, evaluations commissioned by geographic and sectoral areas of DFAT, which I assume would include independent completion reports. Yep. So there were some 86 of those operational evaluations in 2012. So that's a lot of evaluations that are not part of this picture. Nor does the lessons learned report take into account performance information on partnerships with multilateral organisations or non-government organisations, because the systems for gathering that information are either new or under development, respectively. So the omission of information from operational evaluations is obviously striking and, on the face of it, pretty odd. But we learn at the very end of the report that information will be included in 2014 and subsequent lessons learned reports. And we also learn that a review of operational evaluations is underway, looking at those completed in 2012. Now, even allowing that the lessons learned report is a new process and therefore overlaps in various ways with some pre-existing processes, it's hard to understand why it was released after the annual review of aid effectiveness and before the review of operational evaluations. In a perfect world, the review of operational evaluations would have happened first. It would have been a fundamental input to the lessons learned report, which in turn would have been a fundamental input to the annual review of aid effectiveness. But the actual sequencing was precisely the opposite. Annual review first, lessons learned second, review of operational evaluations not yet. So let's hope the sequencing is the other way around in 2014, which would make much more sense. Now, I want to look only very briefly at the actual lessons learned. Three of them, as we saw, are highlighted. Two of them are the same as those highlighted in the APPR review. So the two common lessons are that effective policy dialogue is important and that taking a more institutional view of capacity building is important. Then the third lesson is that the aid program should harness the strengths of civil society and the private sector. So two of these three lessons happen to relate to the topics of ODE strategic evaluations, and the third on capacity building really serves to sweep together the other strategic evaluations. So it looks kind of like ODE was either very prescient in its choice of strategic evaluation topics, or else it looks like whatever ODE chose to study was deemed to be a major driver of good program performance. And I'd bet a little bit more on the latter. Now, if that seems a bit unfair, it's actually worth going back and having a look at the quite thorough review of operational evaluations, which was done for the Independent Review of Aid Effectiveness. That was commissioned in 2011. It reported in March 2011. Now, that review produced some of the same findings, but it embedded them in broader and, I think, intuitively more credible lessons, such as, to quote, well-contextualised design with strong ownership and leadership by partner governments and intelligent, analytical and responsive implementation were the principal drivers of effectiveness. That review also found a close correlation between greater use of government systems and sustainability, a point on which the ODE report is largely silent, except, by the way, that it blames some of the low M&E ratings on reliance on partner government systems, which I found a little surprising. Now, it seems quite odd that the Lessons Learned report has nothing to say about alignment, flexibility, and the use of partner government systems. Now, I have a slightly bigger beef than that, which is that the ODE report is based very heavily on aid managers' perceptions of how their activities or programs are going, or on ODE's assessments of how well-founded those perceptions are. The findings of strategic evaluations play a part, but those evaluations aggregate lots of activities, and they also tend to dwell pretty heavily on activities in implementation rather than completed activities. There's currently quite a striking absence of interest in the outcomes and impacts of completed activities. This is reflected, for example, in the benchmark previously used in the AusAid annual report for activity quality, which is 75% of active programs are expected to have satisfactory QAI ratings. If you look at the World Bank's corporate scorecard, by contrast, it has a 75% target for completed activities, and that's a more meaningful and a more demanding target, given the well-documented upward bias in managers' activity ratings for activities in implementation. So the inclusion in future years of information from operational evaluations, including those independent completion reports, is a positive step. I note, by the way, that I think ICR compliance is way lower than QAI compliance.
So ICRs are not part of the compliance system, so as somebody here knows better than me, but just an independent evaluation during the life of the programme is what is required. So that might be...
They've been replaced by a final QAI, and we'll be looking at what's happened since they've introduced that final QAI approach this year.
Okay, we'll come back to that. But so having that information from operational evaluations in the future will be certainly a positive step, but it won't necessarily change the balance as much as it should toward assessing the impacts of completed activities. So while ODE is expected to help the agency keep current activities on track... which is an important task, it's less able to draw valuable lessons about what's worked in the past and what might work in the future. So I think, certainly there's a role for ODE in quality assuring DFAT's aid management systems, quality assuring the quality assurance systems, basically, including through spot checks, APPR reviews and so on. That's an important function. But I think ODE's flagship publication, which is what this publication would hopefully become, should focus on impacts and lessons learned, not so much on reporting on the perceived quality of the active portfolio. The latter task would better be left to the annual review of aid effectiveness. And finally, it's a concern that the quality of program M&E is consistently lower than it should be according to those QAI assessments, and that's compounded by the fact that according to the ODE report, something like 20% of QAI scores are too high, though we don't know how far they're too high. Given those facts, it's a bit surprising that QAI scores don't get adjusted following ODE spot checks. It shouldn't be ODE's job to do data cleansing for the whole agency, but when ODE points to problems, somebody should at least do some cleansing in the areas where they're known to exist. And that'll become all the more important once aid management benchmarks are defined by the present government. So, overall, I think the Lessons Learned report has a long way to go, and that's been acknowledged by ODE in this first report. future reports, I think, need to fully incorporate performance information from the full range of performance information systems and become less susceptible to seeing the lessons that they go looking for. I think future reports need to place a lot more emphasis on lessons from completed activities and on portfolio quality as measured with respect to completed activities. And reporting on perceptions of the quality of the active portfolio is better left to the aid operations arm of DFAT and the annual review of aid effectiveness. Okay.
Great, thank you, Raman. We have quite a good amount of time left for questions, so I think we'll do the same as we did last time, where we take a few at a time. Anyone? Julie?
I just want to pick up on one of the points that Robin made about the lessons learned that are drawn out of the first part of this report. And, you know, whilst I think the general point you made about drawing lessons from the operational evaluations is sensible, and clearly there was a timing issue that didn't seem to not make it possible here. Nevertheless, the lesson you chose to read out about increased sustainability based on using partner government systems is surely, it's the sort of thing that the DAC writes up and the World Bank writes up. I mean, it's sort of embedded in the development knowledge. And yet, when you're working in a country like PNG, and I think Joe pointed out that broadly this work has been in fragile states, getting to that desirable endpoint is I'm not sure that work. I mean, clearly there's a heck of a lot of working through government systems in Papua New Guinea that has been anything but sustainable. So, there's the reality there. So, I guess there's the extent to which these sorts of reports simply restate the sort of received wisdom of the DAC is the value of that is really questionable to me. And I think the report actually should play a role in synthesizing and reminding some of the findings that have come out of broader ODE work. So, I think there is value in that the commentary that was brought out in this report is not simply restating already received wisdom. So what balance? Probably tailored off to something. It's not too
important. Do you want to take that or should we get some more?
Have
we got any other questions, Stephen?
Yeah, I'm happy to ask a question. I just wanted to, Joe, if you could, you can respond to Robin, but that point about whether you re-rate the quality ratings take into account the output bias. And I especially note, right, that you find that more than 20% of the sustainability programs, sustainability ratings that are rated satisfactory should be rated unsatisfactory. It seems to me to take your sustainability rating in a satisfactory rating down to about 60%, right, which is not much more than half, which means there's a serious problem with sustainability,
sure,
which would come out if you'd actually gave us numbers.
Do you want to take those two now?
Yeah.
There's a fair bit in those.
Okay. Well, it's your age. So, Julia, yeah, that review that was done in early 2011, it wasn't a piece of advocacy. It was based on a review of, I think, more than 160 operational evaluations, mostly independent completion reports that have been done over about a 3 or 4 year period. So that they were drawing that conclusion from a very broad array of evaluations of specific activities.
But it's a well-established problem.
Sure. Whether we're really working through partner government systems that much in PNG, that's debatable. But I get the point. On the other thing, though, yes, there's value in synthesising ODE findings, but I think there's a need for caution in then generalising and saying these are the lessons from the implementation of the Australian aid program over the last year or whatever. No, these are the lessons drawn from the things we have chosen to study.
Mm.
And it's a different, I guess it's a different frame.
Stephen, so re-rating the quality rating. So on the sustainability one, yes, we've got a problem with sustainability. I think we've kind of highlighted that in sort of spades, that, and I think the problem is that we're not really sure what it means. And we're not necessarily sure what it means in different contexts. So I spent some time discovering that, talking to the governance people to say, okay, you know, I think this is something we should take on. This is actually quite a major problem we've got. We don't re-rate them because when we do the spot check, we don't say that this was, you know, this was 1 point or 2 points or whatever overrated. We, there's a little footnote in the report somewhere that talks about if of all the fours that were rated in sustainability, there were one wrong, then it would have, you know, fallen to below satisfactory. So your estimate is probably correct, but we don't at the moment re-rate. Now, there's a lot of questions about whether or not we should get involved in validating some of these ratings. Derek mentioned a second ago that the quality, the QAI final report is a relatively new product that's come out sort of in the last 12 months. We will be looking at that with some rigour in this next round of QAIs. And we will be looking, in particular, the Independent Evaluation Committee has been keen on this idea of validating QAI final reports, so we'll be looking at that. That's all I can say, is that we'll be looking at it. So, but yes, whether or not we should be involved in full-scale re-rating of the QAIs, like you said, I don't think that's a role for ODE, but certainly something that the agency might like to consider. But then within the simplification agenda, but also within the, you know, this importance of, also, you know, how much importance do we attach to the evaluations as opposed to the QAI reports and so on. We need to balance how much resources are going to go into all of these different products. I would just mention on the operational evaluation, so Sam is in charge of this review, which I think you're going to love when it comes out, because it's a fun piece of work. But I did notice that in 2011, the review that was done, I think the consultant says in the report that 20 minutes were spent per report. We had a much richer methodology that we think will really be able to explore those reports that we looked at, these 86 reports, in more detail than could have happened in those 20 minutes. So I'll just mention it.
Thanks.
Simon Ernst from ODE, previously from PPD, where one of my principal responsibilities was overseeing the processes that we've been examining. So just on the question of re-rating, it's more a comment or a point of an explanation, I guess, is that what is now a management contracting division, what was previously PEPD, does a process of moderation. The year that we're looking at here, PEPD moderated something like 100 initiatives. For the period just closed, it was close to 200. So we're talking about perhaps 40% of the initiatives across the agency were looked at by a team of four or five people, and in many cases that involved re-rating. And in fact, the QAI spot check, which the LAR draws upon, offers some observations about moderation and what that does for robustness. So there is in fact a process of re-rating that does occur. That occurs between the corporate area and the programs, the operational areas, if you like, that's not over there. I then also just wanted to, I guess, take issue or to push you a little bit, Robin, on your recommendation about country program objectives and your exhortation that they be more tightly focused, you know, specific, measurable, relevant, achievable, time-bound. And really, I really ponder the degree to which we can realistically get those kind of objectives at a country program level, where we're talking about objectives that need to cover three to five-year time span. You mentioned Indonesia. Indonesia this year has 49 separate QAI reports. Each of those QAIs or each of those projects has two or objectives. So the idea that you can get all those, you know, those hundreds of objectives all to neatly line up under 3 to 5 objectives that are going to remain relevant over an extended period of time, and to be easily measurable in a very straightforward and simple measure, in a simple manner, is it's a nice wish, but that's certainly a task beyond me. And that's I think, really where I think the PATH comes in, and that's how I understand the performance assessment framework. It helps DFAT program managers, it helps people reading those reports to understand how those necessarily fairly vague and aspirational objectives have been interpreted in an operational sense.
Do you want to take, should we take some more?
Yeah, I just don't understand that. So, I mean, there's a clear recommendation of this lessons learned exercise, well, in fact, the APPR review, that there should be a PATH for every program.
Yep.
Containing sharply defined, measurable, time-bound, blah, 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 objectives. If it's possible, it's possible. They don't have to be stable for 5 years. That's not necessary at all. In fact, that's always been one of the weaknesses of country strategy objectives in the past. People thought they had to be reasonably robust over 3 to 5 year periods, and you just can't do that. I think the key thing is that they're updated probably once a year when you're going into your APPR process. They may need some revision, might reduce comparability across years, bad luck if it maintains relevance. But if you can do it for a PAT, why not just do it for a country strategy?
So I agree with this issue of objectives is not a new one. It's been around certainly ever since ODE's been around. They have always been pitched to a higher level and too vague to actually be meaningful. And it's come up in every APPR quality review that we've done over the last 4 or 5 years. In this particular quality review, we kind of got a bit exhausted by it. So we were saying, rather than banging on again about you've got to have clear measurable objectives, we actually looked at that particular quality criteria. We said, okay, let's see if we can find out from the narrative what they actually were intending to do and rate against that, rather than, because if we rated against having clear objectives, then everything would fail. And the APPRs are too important documents to take that kind of pedantic view of them. And I don't know what the answer is, because I think if you keep pushing for more, objectives are quite political statements, and there's a sort of, it, just by telling people they've got to be clearer and sharper, it's not worked. We've done that for years, and that doesn't work. So maybe the idea is that you can actually state what you're intending to achieve. You've got your headline objective, but then you actually state what the real intention was a bit below that, as an intermediate objective, or just as a little sentence in the narrative. And I actually think that's probably the more realistic way that we're likely to go. So the PATH question, I hate the idea of having another blessed matrix sitting at the end of your country strategy that is never ever used. That was the old way that we used to do performance assessment frameworks. I think the emphasis should be on a sensible way of measuring performance against your country strategy, and that to me, it could be a performance assessment framework or it could be any other means, as long as it is clear that there is evidence that you are making progress and that will support your amber or your green rating. And at the moment it's a bit all over the shop, and we're saying everyone needs to be clear on what good performance looks like and what poor performance looks like, and that is the key to the APPRs. And that's where we think the focus should be. So not on the bureaucracy of having another requirement for another matrix or something, but actually having people understand what it means for a program to be working successfully.
Yeah, I can understand that from a pragmatic perspective, but it does look like a kind of application of the policy dialogue responsibility, which is discussed so much in both of these reports. So I wonder if we're underestimating the ability and willingness of our partner governments to agree to objectives at a slightly more specific level. And the process itself then becomes important in producing a more strategic program.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's necessarily our partner governments that are the problem.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's ours.
All right, we have time for another round.
Yeah. Bill Standish by name. I'm a political observer, I guess. We've had two phrases used, fairly vague and aspirational objectives. And objectives are quite political statements. I'm wondering if in the future we're really going to hear about the objectives out in the public arena and whether they can be assessed in any way when we are told the new government's aid policy is moving towards promoting the national interest, which is as vague and political as you can possibly get, and whether, in fact, this will be part of the dialogue with the partner governments, etc. Is anybody prepared to comment on this?
Look, this is just a quick personal comment. I think that's a really interesting observation, and one that I'm personally been thinking about quite a lot over the last couple of months, because it would be nice if the new wave of APPRs all started off with a paragraph or two that clearly states what the government's national interest in X country is and how the aid program is supporting A, national interest, B, aid for trade, and whatever else the government might see us as being part of a more unified approach, obviously the other one, sorry, the foreign affairs objectives. Our colleagues in foreign affairs or the department aren't used to this type of, if you like, a clear enunciation at any one stage, because they see it as a very movable feast during the year, reacting to all sorts of issues and conditions. But if the aid program is indeed going to be more closely sewed up with national interest, aid for trade, and our diplomatic objectives, let's state them. And they might be very different in Tonga as they are in Indonesia or Vietnam. And it's only then that you can see, is this beginning to drive the kind of activities we're doing in the aid program? And is there a logic behind it? One of the national interests in Indonesia might have been a year ago improving abattoirs because of our live cattle export. Are we doing anything in the aid program to do this? Yes, we are. Okay, well, people can see there's a line of sight going on here. I'm not sure that's going to happen quickly, but I don't think it's impossible. It would require a slightly different mindset to how we go about writing APPRs, but I would like to see each one start with exactly that enunciation.
Does anyone on the panel want to add anything to that? We'll take another question.
Yeah, I'm Andrew Roll from Care Australia. Just looking at a couple of lessons coming out of the LAHA, and particularly I guess the one around policy dialogue helping increase the reach of aid, and it's certainly something in NGOs we're interested in that. And it talks about harnessing the strength of the civil society and a CEO role that NGOs do have a role there. I guess in practice we have found fear or caution in some bits of AusAid around NGOs' role in policy dialogue, and yeah, there's been times engaging with some desks in DFAT of wanting to sort of send the earlier ADE report on policy dialogue along with it to say, see, you know, we're allowed to do this, you guys think it's a good thing. So I guess I'd be interested in your sense of what traction the policy dialogue recommendation may have with the new government. I think there's elements of sort of perhaps lack of clarity around what role NGOs might have in policy dialogue, and we need to explain better what we think our value add might be. I think sometimes there's a bit of risk aversion, particularly if there's material which might be made publicly of DFAT being seen to support NGOs to do advocacy or that kind of work. And sometimes there's a bit of a question around, you know, well, in Cambodia, policy dialogue on the quality of provincial health services is a good thing. Perhaps policy dialogue on impacts on communities of large infrastructure projects like railway programs might not be a good thing to bring to be involved in. So I guess it's a bit of an observation, but just wondering if you see that policy dialogue recommendation has some traction under the new order.
And should we take one more? Did I see another over here somewhere? No, perhaps just throw that on.
So I can only think that of, as you were talking, Andrew, about CAS program in Cambodia that works with language teaching in schools, and it was tried as a little pilot, and then it suddenly became, well, not suddenly, through many years of perseverance, became part of government's policy. To me, that's policy dialogue in its finest sort of example of it. So I'm kind of don't really see what the problem is. I don't know what kind of reaction you're getting out of various places in DFAT, but to me, if the NGOs are not engaging in this stuff, then, and they think they're going to change the world through individual projects alone, well, then we've just gone back 50 years. So, you know, I think obviously it's going to be part of the work of non-government organisations, the same as it would be the work of anybody working in development. So, if you like, that's. But I don't know what kind of reaction you've been getting out of other parts of DFAT.
That's a brief comment. I mean, I guess foreign ministers and ministries tend not to be that attracted to demand-side governance initiatives, and it's hard to judge whether this government will be any different from the previous one in that respect, but the integration could, you know, could be a factor, could make life a little bit harder for those interested in support for demand-side initiatives. But there are sort of two forms of policy dialogue that don't really get a run in the reports. There's the sort where we talk to another government and we ask them, how can we help you, how can we align with your priorities? You know, the way policy dialogue is described in the report is very much about how can we change their policies. We have a fine policy dialogue going on right now in Papua New Guinea, we're being very helpful. You know, but that sort of alignment is not really discussed, and I think we'll see a bit of that where there are other broader national interests in play. And then the second thing is, before the election, the government talked about doing a lot more to draw on Australian sources of policy expertise and people in, you know, central industries in developing countries and so on, plug policy development gaps. So that's sort of something I think you'll probably see more of that happening than previously.
Great. If we don't have any more questions, I might now invite Jim Adams to come up to give the concluding remarks. Jim's the chair of the Independent Evaluation Committee, and we did have him speak at DEF Policy last year in November, and that's very popular. We've been hearing lots of compliments about that talk. So over to you, Jim.
Well, thank you very much. I stand between everyone and lunch, so I will be short and focused. I want to start by thanking the Centre and Stephen specifically for the interest in evaluation, because this is not a general phenomenon, and I think it's very important that that interest be sustained, and the effort that the Centre and Stephen have taken I think is very important for Australian aid. Secondly, that everybody comes and participates I think is also encouraging. We had obviously some people specifically interested in the one report, but I think more generally there's an interest in evaluation, which I am impressed by. What I thought I'd do is just make a couple of observations about the IEC and a couple of random observations reacting to the discussions we had today. I have another IEC member here, Wendy Jarvis, and there actually is some competence. I'm not an evaluator, but fortunately Wendy and our other participant, Patricia Rogers, really are experts, and that provides a lot of the substantive input. We meet quarterly. We review all of the products that are now produced from OED. A lot of emphasis on quality and working on the quality, so we take some responsibility for the products that have been produced. We do have some general concerns that we're working on, some of which have emerged today. One very real concern is the availability of data in the reports and ensuring that appropriate data is used. We talk a lot about value for money, which hasn't really come up today, but it is a concern to focus on that. And the final one, which I'll just come back to because it was mentioned, was on ICRs. The present requirement is that there be one independent evaluation during the process of a project's implementation. And you, in the discussion, a weakness in that was noticed, which is a concern of the IEC, that you don't have a comprehensive set of data about projects that have been completed and some independent assessment. And the point was made, some organizations do have the ability to do that, so it's an issue we're actively talking to the management about. We spent a lot of time focusing on delivery. There have been concerns when you look at the history of ODE that sometimes products weren't delivered. I think the present group is working very hard, and this year there'll be a full set of reports produced. We also spend time talking about transparency. We think it's very important that these information get outside, not just within the organization, but to the public in Australia. And actually, there will be broader interest in that, because I do think it's a model that's being looked at by other countries that are interested in this. We quite welcome any suggestions. We do review the program reaching out. And so if people have suggestions and ideas, please feel free to get in touch with Derek here, because we are always looking at making sure that there's a relevance to the overall program, because significant resources are being spent on these activities. A couple of comments, just concluding comments on today. I have to say it was a rich discussion, a lot of suggestions, but I also have to be honest. I feel particularly with Andrew sitting there. You know, the people that are doing this work are subject to budget constraints, and they are subject to discipline in terms of producing documents. And so while consultants work very hard and ODE works very hard with them to make sure quality products improve, you can't deal with everything. So I just want to make sure that's understood. There's not a limited budget for this activity. I also want to make one comment about the volunteers thing, which actually someone in the audience mentioned, which I don't think got enough attention. You know, if 30% of the people that are going on volunteers end up in the development business, that's an enormous percentage of the people working on development. So in some sense, regardless of what the narrow experiences are, the fact of the matter is this is a fundamental contribution everything the country's doing and thinking about development. And I just wanted to emphasize that because it was something that was important. On the law, I want to be a bit naughty because I have some personal views on this, and I think it got a bit lost in the discussion. A lot of money is being spent on evaluation by Australia. And I think it's fair to say that right now the outreach of that within the community, technical people will read their technical reports. So if you do a report on civil society, as Joe did, the people involved in civil society will read that. But you've got a lot of other people in the system that are managing and responsible for making decisions. And I think the gap the law has to try to fill is to take the work that's being done under the evaluation rubric within ODEA, within DFAT, and providing some of the judgments that are reached as a result. They may not be sometimes as profound as people may want, and they may not always, answer all the questions. But if somebody doesn't spend time collecting that experience, the simple fact of the matter is you'll be spending a lot of money on evaluation, which will not be having broad effect with the generalists and with the people that simply don't have the time or the ability to reach down and review all the detailed reports. And so I think that aspect of it is something I thought was a little missing in the discussion, and I'd like to present it because in my experience and reflecting my World Bank experience, everybody wants to know about the sort of accountability parts of evaluation. And yes, accountability is an important aspect. But what I think gets lost in the development business is actually the learning part. And that if more broadly people absorb the learning lessons and were able to see them in a way that is absorbable through a document like LAR, I think it will make a major contribution with all the limitations that were identified. Finally, just to comment on the last part of the discussion, gets into this whole question of impact. I do think that results and impact are more important issues in development. I think they are important issues that have to be focused on. But the warning I always give is that some people take this to a level where they think you could draw direct lines between projects and programs and results. And I remind people that there's always a government on the other side of that equation. And whether you like it or not, no matter how important your program is, you do not control that government. The government is the one that in the end is going to be responsible for implementing programs. So more focus on impact, yes. More focus on results, yes. But always keep it in mind that there is not that direct linkage, because if people start holding aid programs responsible for making that direct linkage, there's no way I think you can have a balanced and realistic discussion of where there is real progress and where there are problems and issues and how you resolve them. So I just want to close by I think today was an excellent seminar. I enjoyed it a lot. I think continuing seminars like this will be enormously helpful to DFAT and ODE, so I do want to encourage ANU in that respect. And I look forward to continuing what I think has been a very constructive dialogue on both some specific programs today, but more importantly, a broader discussion on ensuring that good evaluation is done and good evaluation is disseminated within people interested in development in Australia. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Jim, and thanks to all of you who've stayed to the end. So you now be rewarded with free lunch. It should be outside. And, you know, hope you do it again next year, Derek. And in the meantime, if anyone wants to write a blog, one of these evaluations, we always welcome your contributions. All right, thanks to everyone.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.